This is Alaskan Legislative Review, a program of analysis of Alaskan legislative issues and processes, featuring faculty and staff of the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. Today's host is former legislator and current faculty member of the U of A Political Science Department, Brian Rogers.
Good evening and welcome to Alaskan Legislative Review, a program that brings you University of Alaska faculty speaking on issues before the 13th Alaska Legislature. And one of the issues before the legislature this year has been that of organized research at the University of Alaska. There have been some charges that organized researchers are overpaid, non-productive, that the organized research is not well coordinated with the educational programs of the University of Alaska. There have been actions by the House Finance Committee to eliminate funding for two of the University of Alaska's research institutes, and charges in the Senate Finance Committee that the state funding of organized research is a waste of state money and that there's no direction to state research. With me today I have two members of the University of Alaska Fairbanks community. Steve McLean is a professor of zoology with the Division of Life Sciences, and Merrick Helfrich is the head of the Technical Services Division of the Geophysical Institute. Welcome.
Thank you.
Steve, perhaps we could begin the program by just asking you what you do that involves organized research and academic affairs at the university, so we can help our listeners understand the role of organized research at the University of Alaska.
Well, my position in the Division of Life Sciences involves an instructional appointment in the Department of Biological Sciences and a research appointment in the Institute of Arctic Biology. So I have a rather full instructional responsibility for the nine-month academic year, and in fact spent the last 4 years as chairman of the instructional program of biological sciences. In addition, I'm involved in research on animal populations of Arctic and subarctic Alaska during the summer.
Okay, so your position then, 9 months essentially instruction, 3 months essentially research.
I'm usually funded 6, 7, 8, up to 9 months for instruction, with research making up in the rest of the contract. And the year-to-year variation has to do with my success in gaining funding from national support agencies, such as the National Science Foundation, to support my research activities.
Okay, I think we'd like to get back to that in just a moment. But first, Merrick, can you tell the listening audience what the Technical Services Division does at the Geophysical Institute, maybe a little bit about the Institute?
We provide support to researchers and graduate students in doing research projects. And this is a very complex support activity, because much of the research which is done requires new techniques and a lot of field work. So we have people of various technological capacities who design and build equipment and who go into the field to operate it to gain data for the project.
Well, Merritt, in the university budget, all of the funding for organized research is shown as a component of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And there have been charges that only Fairbanks benefits from organized research. How would you respond to that?
I'd respond that is a gross difficulty with perception of what happens, actually. Research projects of the whole research group are conducted throughout Alaska and even in other countries. We have stations, the Geophysical Institute has stations in Fort Yukon and has had stations in Barrow and Kotzebue and many other localities, Homer, Sitka, Kodiak. Some of these stations are manned for a period of time. Some of the stations are automatic, but people, technicians and scientists go to the various places throughout Alaska for various data collection projects. And so we're not just studying things in Fairbanks, and we're not just applying our efforts in Fairbanks. It's all over the state.
Merritt, who pays for the work that's done at the Geophysical Institute?
The funding is approximately 80% from sources other than the state of Alaska. Many of the projects which we do are of national or international interest. Money comes from the National Science Foundation, it comes from the Defense Department, it comes from other departments of the federal government. It comes occasionally from private concerns, such as oil companies who have specific questions that need to be addressed that can only be addressed by the people that are here, because the talents are here and the knowledge is here. And as I said, about 20% comes from the state of Alaska.
What do, of the 20% that comes from the state of Alaska, you're saying then we essentially get five times as much work done as the state is putting in. What does that state money pay for?
The state money frequently pays for projects which are of specific interest to the state.
Can you give an example?
One example is our studies in seismology. And the federal government has taken the tack that the seismological problems, the tectonic problems of Alaska are Alaska's problem, and so has dropped their funding for these projects. And since there is a great need for consistency of data collection over a long period of time in order to understand the forces that are at work within Alaska that cause earthquakes and the movement of the ground and formation of the mountains, we need to continue to do that work, and a considerable amount of state money has gone into continuing that particular work. And there are other projects, too.
Okay, now what might be the, one of the confusions, I think, and one of the problems in the legislature is looking at research and wondering what kind of production is there from it? What kind of tangible benefit is there to something that begins as basic or pure research? Sort of for the expansion of knowledge. I wonder, taking seismology, can you give some examples of what might be the benefits either in the short term and the long term of seismology or other work that the Geophysical Institute is doing?
In the short term, in a year perhaps, no one will see anything they can identify as a change in our way of life or in our technology because of it. It makes it very difficult sometimes for people to comprehend because many of these changes are over a long period. But in seismology, the studies of seismic activity have led to changes in building codes and construction techniques to reduce the hazard to life in case of seismic events. It's also resulted in the long-term understanding of the forces that are working the Earth. It has resulted in the long term in knowledge about what areas are seismically active and are which are likely to have seismic events in the nature of buildings that need to be constructed or other human activities that need to be or not need to be done in that area. And it also ties in with things like tsunamis, the tidal waves, and knowledge about how to build along shorelines, how to build oil drilling rigs to take in the event of seismic activities, so that there are most research is not really a short-term investment; it's a long-term investment, and so the continuity is necessary to reach that long-term goal.
Okay, thank you. Let's turn back to Steve. One of the charges that was made at the time that two of the institutes were defunded was that there isn't enough coordination between the research component and the academic component at the university, and that research draws away from state funding for educational programs. I wonder if you could talk a little bit from your own experience about the interactions between research and the academics, and what would happen if we were just to wipe out all of the organized research at the University of Alaska.
Historically, that situation you described might well have been true. The research arm of the university developed rather independently from the instructional arm. However, over the last five, six or more years, research and instruction have been drawn ever more closely together, so that right now the research faculty are by and large involved in teaching courses at all levels, and the traditional instructional faculty are increasingly involved in research. Many of the people hired on research contracts in the Institute of Arctic Biology teach courses within the program in biological sciences, and we depend very heavily upon their expertise. We might take as an example physics. You could probably teach all of the courses listed in the university catalog with three physicists doing nothing but teaching. However, with the presence of a very strong research arm in geophysics, the students interested in physics are exposed to the ideas of 30 different physicists presenting research-oriented seminars that students are invited and encouraged to attend, giving advanced courses, giving graduate courses. So I think we have very strong instructional programs as a direct consequence of the very heavy research involvement at this campus and the university in general. I think the instructional programs would fall off in quality drastically if we were to lose the research arm of the university.
How about from the point of view of an individual faculty member? Is it more attractive, does the University of Alaska attract better faculty, do you think, because it is both a research and an academic
Absolutely, absolutely. There are many reasons for top flight scientists and biologists, physicists, geologists to come to Alaska because of the research opportunities that it allows. Those people then are involved in the instructional program and bring their special skills and expertise to bear in the instructional arena. That's the recruitment advantage of the research opportunities and the basis for research that exists in the organized research units is a very definite recruiting advantage.
So you're saying then that the university gains in two ways from the research community. One, a breadth of program because we have that many more faculty members around who can teach, and secondly, in the quality of the people that we're able to attract.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, one of the questions people ask about professors who are, say, principally research, one of the questions that's come up is that of tenure. The question of, is tenure justified for someone who is not on state funding? I know this has been a very hot issue within the university community, and apparently the legislature is getting into it as well. Would either of you like to respond to the tenure issue for research faculty?
Well, first of all, the chancellor of the Fairbanks campus has responded to that situation by trying to increase the involvement of state-supported activities and the instructional involvement of research faculty. He sees a weakness in having a dichotomy of kinds of faculty. I don't think the solution is to jerk tenure away from a large segment of productive members of the academic community. I think the solution is to produce a single category of faculty members jointly involved in instruction and research and in tenurable faculty positions.
So then you're saying, well, go ahead, Merrick, if you...
One of the major questions about tenure is a matter of academic freedom. And one may attempt to downplay that aspect of tenure and the necessity for it by saying, well, we're all striving for good and truth, but frequently questions come up where an individual faculty member who has done some research into some particular aspect of nature has an answer which is not popular. And it may not be popular from a political point of view, even though it's true. And pressures have been placed on people in the past, severe pressures, and even at the University of Alaska many, many years ago, to not speak their mind and the truth as they see it on important issues, which is to the disadvantage of the community as a whole. Without the protection of tenure, which allows them to continue in their job and speak their minds, there is some difficulty in encouraging those people to speak on controversial issues.
So you're saying that protection of academic freedom, that tenure is the best tool we have to protect that academic freedom?
It's the best one. It is not the best one that one might want, but is the best one that people have been able to come up with. And that applies both to non-teaching research faculty as well as teaching research faculty, because in both cases, people may have something that needs to be said, and those people need the protection of a tenure.
I'd like to go a little bit further then into the economics of research at the university. There are two questions. First, let's say, what is the impact on the economy of the state of the presence of organized research at the university? Is it a positive impact? Is it just a drain on the state treasury? How do you see that, Merritt? And then, Steve, I'll ask you the same question.
Well, if you look at it in just very sort of greedy terms, it's not greedy, but if you look at it in very practical monetary terms, as you mentioned before, there's about a 5-to-1 ratio between the money the state spends and the money that individual researchers are able to bring in for research projects. So I don't recall exactly what the numbers are, but there are very many tens of millions of dollars that are brought into the state for salaries, for products which are sold by local merchants, and that money floats around, and it breeds more jobs and more activities for people in Alaska. So a 5-to-1 investment ratio is not so bad. And that money is not just in Fairbanks, it spreads out over the state.
Steve, let me ask you the same question. What do you see as the economic impact then of research at the university?
Well, very considerable amount of money from outside of the state comes in to support the activities of professorial level researchers, technicians, support staff. They're all a part of the local economies of Fairbanks, Anchorage, and as Merritt pointed out, lots of other communities around Alaska as well. It's a considerable input into the economy. There's also an output that comes from this, and the output that comes from this is trained graduate students who move into positions within government agencies, state of Alaska, and continue then to contribute in the future.
So then one of the secondary impacts you're saying is that those people can move into the public and private sector into positions that otherwise would be filled by people outside the state.
As an Alaskan, not necessarily as a member of the university, but as an Alaskan, I far prefer to see students trained in Alaska taking positions with the Department of Fish and Game, Department of Environmental Conservation, any of the state agencies, than I do students trained in Arizona or Louisiana or South Carolina.
There have been some rather remarkable examples of lack of understanding of Alaskan conditions expressed in buildings and other products by people who came here on a consultancy basis to build something or to make recommendations to the state or to private concerns in the oil companies. Sometimes it results in a great loss of money and a disaster because they aren't aware of the conditions, and frequently they aren't part of the community, and they don't have the interests of the community at heart. What they're interested in is a job, and they come to Alaska and then they go away. But here there are people who are not only frequently raised here, but who are educated here, who then who accumulate some interest, a great interest in the welfare of the state.
One other economic question has concerned the pay scales of university faculty in general, the research faculty in particular, and I have a couple of questions there concerning the pay. Number one, is the pay for a university researcher comparable to the pay for a university researcher elsewhere? And two, how would it compare with what a person could earn in the private sector? And either one of you can take that one.
In dollars on the bottom of the contract, it looks like a very large total. I think that could be said for anyone who's employed in Alaska. A recent survey done in the office of the president that was contracted, not done with in-house, but contracted by the office of the president, showed that the pay scale was completely compatible with that which exists in comparable outside universities, and generally is less than what could be attained for comparable levels of training and experience in industry. One should also bear in mind that there is not a separate pay scale for researchers and instructional faculty. It is a single faculty pay scale, so mm-hmm. It's a little bit unfair to isolate the research faculty in this way.
Okay, Merritt, do you want to respond at all to that question?
Yeah, a little bit. What you're saying is absolutely correct. But even if you didn't believe the report that the university contracted, there are a variety of disciplines within the university. And in the research area, most often we are competing with a different group of people, a different group of concerns or universities for talented people than the purely instructional staff. In the research area, we may be competing with very high-level universities throughout the United States. To look at the university as a whole without separating out the elements it can lead to some errors in judgment about our salary scale.
Okay, I'd like to get into a little more theory at this point. There seems to be a feeling at the university that the legislature doesn't understand organized research, and a feeling among legislators that that faculty and staff at the university don't understand the legislative process. What methods might we use to improve the understanding of each group of the other group, and what should the long-term relationship be between the university, including organized research, and the legislature?
Well, first of all, I agree with both of those observations. I don't think that the legislature fully understands the university, and I'm quite certain that the faculty don't understand the machinations that go on in Juneau. We do need to take every opportunity to inform the state and the citizens, as well as the legislators, of exactly what it is that we do and how it contributes. I would like to see more contact between individual faculty members and the legislators. I'd like to see individual faculty going to Juneau or going to hearings in Fairbanks and Anchorage and explaining what it is that they do. I think the faculty members can do a better job of explaining what they do than the administrators. As for learning more about how Juneau works, I'm at a loss.
Okay. Merritt, do you want to respond to that one?
Well, I feel that the legislature has a very distinct responsibility to look at what the university does and decide whether or not is it of value to the state. But they can't do that in a vacuum. And I'm afraid that what they look at is an overall pot of money without a clear understanding of what we're engaged in and why. And to do that is to operate on insufficient information. If a legislator looks at a university professor's salary and then looks at what he pays some employee, he will say, well, we're paying them too much, and feel bad about the whole university budget. But if he understood what the whole environment of it was, he might feel entirely differently about it. And I think that the legislature really has a responsibility beyond that of the university professor to come to the university and to gain a further understanding.
Okay, so one of the methods might be to bring people to the various campuses.
Absolutely.
And give them on-site experience. Steve, I'd like to go back a little bit and let's try explaining what a researcher does, and perhaps look at your research in animal populations. I wonder if you could describe what the work you're doing in the research portion of your work is, and then how does that relate to your teaching during the rest of the year?
Well, I've been interested for some years in how animals exist in Arctic and subarctic environments, and one might say, ask the question, how would the environment be different if there weren't animals in it? I've worked on a variety of organisms, from birds, small mammals, and most of my interest now is in insects. We have one of the areas that we're proposing, and this might be an interesting one for discussion. We are proposing now that we will, to some national funding agencies, not using state money, but pursuing money from the Department of Energy, that we will investigate the riparian ecosystems of Arctic Alaska, the way these work. Why riparian ecosystems? These are prime areas, the first to feel the impact of development. First of all, development on the Arctic slope requires tremendous amounts of gravel, and gravel comes from riparian ecosystems. Riparian ecosystems are natural pathways for routing pipelines and roads. It turns out that riparian ecosystems are also by far the most productive in producing food for caribou and moose, in producing food nesting habitat for birds, and the birds are feeding primarily upon insects that are using those. So we want to find out how the riparian systems work and what their value is to Arctic Alaska, and hopefully to be able to guide development in ways that at least we can point out what will be lost when particular riparian systems are removed and suggest alternative routings, alternative developmental pathways.
Merritt, would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, I'd like to. I think, Steve, you hit on the crux of perhaps a misunderstanding. What you started off by saying was that you are interested in doing this. And I can see a legislator saying, why should I support you in doing something that just interests you? And I think they don't understand that process of your interest and your drive to find out something that they may consider to be really strange, why that is of great value to the society over a period of time, and to Alaska also in the long term. And that problem of understanding right there, I think, is very important.
if we do have essentially self-directed research, that we begin with the individual faculty member saying, this is a direction that, based on my experience, I think we should go, how do we close that loop? How do we make people understand the benefits, if there are going to be any, of that kind of self-directed research?
I think we can do that. What Steve may study, he may discover that he at the end of his study, he doesn't know anything more than he did before, or he may find out theories that he had that were absolutely incorrect. And you could look at it from a knowledgeable way and say, well, that wasn't worth doing. But in fact, it's very valuable, because we have discovered something that didn't work, or he may discover something that does work, and he may, and in both cases, he contributes to man's information. And it's that sort of thing that is very important. He will go to a funding agency and say, I want to discover the riparian ecosystems, and they will say, well, that's a very good idea. And then they will send his proposal to do that work out to a number of scientists throughout the United States who will pick at it and say, oh, well, so-and-so did that in 1938, and we don't like it. But somebody else will pick out some element of it that they feel is really valuable, and eventually through that process, the reports will go back to the National Science Foundation, for example, and they'll say, well, it looks like you've got a good project here, and we'll do it, and we'll give you the money. But it doesn't end there. Maybe you can, I've been talking too much, why don't you, Steve?
Well, there are some checks and balances in this system, and Merritt's described one of them. If I have a particular interest that I think is worth pursuing, I, or usually together with a group of colleagues, because the shift in research has shifted towards integrated research, mm-hmm. we will submit a proposal. So not to the state legislature to use state funds, but to the federal government to use federal funds. If we are successful, then we will pursue that interest. If we are unsuccessful and we're not doing well with those particular interests, the director of my research institute is going to call me into his office and suggest rather pointedly that I redirect my interest into areas that are more productive. And that's something that the system of organized research allows. It allows the director to say, there is an information need in the state. Why don't you respond to that need?
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Merritt. We've been listening tonight to Steve McLean and Merritt Helfrich on Alaska Legislative Review, covering organized research and the issues of organized research before the 13th Alaska State Legislature.
This has been Alaskan Legislative Review, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. Our executive producer is Carla Tonella. Today's host was Brian Rogers. If you would like a cassette copy of today's program, send $5 to KUAC-FM, University of Alaska, Fairbanks, Alaska, 99701.